Here we go. I know, shouldn't speak too soon, should I? If you've only just joined us, we're going verse by verse through the book of Revelation, and like Stalag 13, there is no escape from Revelation. However, today we're doing a little bit of excursus. This is part 40. We'll look a little bit more on Antichrist. We didn't quite finish it off last time. We have a bit of unfinished business. But first, a disclaimer, or actually it's a bit of a reminder. This series, the specifics of this series, who is the beast empire, who is the Antichrist, all that stuff, is based on my best guess for the times we live in. I think the general principles will apply at any time, but for this day and age, I'm guessing and speculating the way I think it works. Now, if the Lord tarries for, say, three more decades, pretty much the specifics that I've said, consider them rubbish. So here's my guarantee, though. If the Lord tarries for 30 years on this day, what is it, 27th of July, 2056, you may come to my front door and tell me I was wrong. All right? I make that promise. Well, you know it's wrong already, right? Anyway, if you weren't here last Sunday week, we examined the mark of the beast, which I suggested is a parody of the Shema. The Shema is the central creed of Judaism. It's one of three passages, little scrolls that are inside the phylacteries, or tefillin as they're called. And we won't read it through again, but part of the Shema is you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. And we reviewed that in Hebraic thought, ancient Hebraic thought, that is, the heart was the organ of reason, which results in our conduct, and our conduct is our walk. Heart is reason, results in walk. And tying tefillin represent the same concept. Our hand is what we do. It's our walk, if you like. And as frontlets between your eyes is our forehead, and that's our reason. That's our heart, in another way of putting it. And so the mark of the beast doesn't have to be a physical thing. It will be the opposite of this. The mark of the beast is reason and conduct in accordance with a different code other than the Holy Scriptures. Now, we're appalled by the things that ISIS did a decade ago, or indeed what the Taliban do today. But they weren't. They thought it was quite normal. Because for them, their heart and their reflected in their walk was based on a different code of conduct. My point is, Christians needn't fear accidentally taking the mark of the beast. It's just not going to happen. Unless, when and if this happens here, we just look the other way and pretend it isn't, and we don't stand. In the lead up to that, we saw the sea beastie. Said the sea beastie is an evil coalition based on all the other evil empires that have oppressed the Jewish people. We also saw an earth beastie, which was like a lamb but spoke the dragon's lies. I didn't think of it at the time, but, you know, those are two sides, again, of Satan's character. As per the previous chapter, Satan is the great dragon, the old serpent. The sea beast is dragon mode. It is a geopolitical empire backed up by military force. The earth beast is the serpent mode, the deceiver that spreads its lies through false ideology and religion. From Revelation 14 onwards, we notice that there's no mention again of the earth beastie. You just hear about the beast and an individual called the false prophet. Moses proclaimed or predicted there would be a prophet like him in Deuteronomy 18:15. Him you shall hear, meaning hear and obey. He said he will be from among you, a prophet like me. We know, of course, that that was the Lord. He was the prophet like Moses that they should have listened to and obeyed. At the moment, he's our great high priest, and he will return as the great messianic king to rule on David's throne. Anybody claiming to be the prophet like Moses after our Lord is clearly a liar. Comes as no surprise that the Beast Empire says that old mate Muhammad was actually the prophet like Moses. It wasn't Jesus, it was this guy. You say, but it said from among his brethren. Yeah, well, that's all right, because according to Islam, Muhammad, Moses, Jesus, King David and Adam were all Muslims. And you can't argue with fact like that, can you? So far, so good. Problem is, in Revelation 13:13, the false prophet performs miracles, even calling fire down from heaven. Now, Elijah showed that he was the true prophet of God by doing that in front of the prophets of Baal, right? And so the Antichrist, the false prophet, call him what you will do something similar to that. It may not be literal fire from heaven. This is apocalyptic literature. But he will work miracles. Won't go there now. You can take my word for it. 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 9 says that he will do miracles, whatever they may be. And of course, the original false prophet never did a miracle in his life, which suggests that there may be another one at the end of the age. You can call them FP1 and FP2 if you like. And both of these false prophets are, of course, antichrists, as we'll see in the definition in a moment. We also reviewed the fact that Nebuchadnezzar's image was worshipped at the audible sound on pain of death, and the image of the beast has certainly been worshipped for many centuries now at the audible sound, today electronically amplified throughout the Muslim world in places like Lakemba in Sydney. We saw that the number of the earth beast, the Antichrist, the false prophet is 666. That is absolutely correct. Hexakosia, hexakonta hex, 666, not 666, despite the fact that a lot of modern translations write it that way to appeal to public sentiment. It is 666. Now, that could be the numerical value of somebody's name using gematria. 666 in Hebrew looks like this. Shesh me'od shashim v'shesh. Six hundreds, sixes, and six. We had a couple of near misses in the Old Testament. A couple of passages that do sort of relate to the end times a bit, but they weren't exactly 666. We had the dimensions of Nebuchadnezzar's image, which was sixes and six. Not quite six hundred sixes and six. And, of course, Goliath with his armour was 666s, but no six on the end. Goliath is a major prophetic picture of the beast, the end-time empire. Everyone was afraid of Goliath. Israel cowered at Goliath. Only David could kill Goliath. And so it is in the last days that only Mashiach ben David, Messiah the son of David, will defeat the final beast. Despite Israel's cleverness, their military know-how, their intel, everything they do, it will fail them in the last days. The only significant reference to the full number we could find in the Bible was in regard to King Solomon's and his annual allotment of gold, 666. So will the false prophet's name be Solomon? Or a derivation thereof, like Shlomo or Salmon or Suleiman. Alternatively, where are we? 1 Chronicles 22, verse 9, his name shall be Solomon, for I will give peace and quietness to Israel in his days. Solomon, peace. Shlomo, shalom. Solomon is a derivation of the word peace. It either means his peace or perhaps man of peace. So will the false prophet masquerade as a man of peace? Now, our concluding question last time was, surely there are other scriptures we can look at to find some more about the Antichrist. There's not that many. There's a few. And don't call me Shirley. Let's move on, see what we can come up with. Since we're in Revelation, apocalyptic literature by John, we should probably start with John's non-apocalyptic writings. There's a passage in 1 John chapter 2, beginning in verse 18. Little children, it is the last hour. Permit me a kol vachomer. If it was the last hour in 96 AD, how much more is it the last hour now? To continue, and as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, the Antichrist word comes straight from the Greek antichristos. It means both opposed to and in place of Christ. And the final false prophet, like the first false prophet and every other false prophet and antichrist we've had, is both opposed to and presents himself in place of Christ. Now, the next bit's important. Even now, many antichrists have come, by which we know that it is the last hour. And how much more is it the last hour now with all the antichrists we've had? Point is, there always will be and always have been antichrists. Here's two of them in this photograph. They look fairly harmless, don't they? But don't be deceived, they're actually antichrists. I saw it on the internet, must be true. In addition, there are many biblical types of the antichrist. This is about nearly, probably every, I haven't checked every, but every, I'll say, good hero in the Bible, in the Old Testament, is a prophetic picture in some way of Jesus. There's something we can learn about Christ from every good guy in the Old Testament. And there are certainly no shortage of bad guys, and they give us something about the Antichrist. Let's just look at three. Three that we've seen in the past. Three famous ones. Here's the first one. Yul Brynner was an Antichrist. Look at those eyes. That's an evil look if ever I saw one. So Yul Brynner, depending on when he really lived, when Moses really lived, scholars disagree. If it was the traditional date, this would have been Pharaoh Amenhotep I. Some say Moses lived a few centuries later, in which case it would have been Ramesses II, whatever. Did he do any miracles? No. His magicians counterfeited some of Moses' miracles, didn't they? They were counterfeit miracles. Maybe that's a clue. There's another one, good old Haman the Agagite. First one to, one of the ones to try genocide on the Jewish people in the book of Esther. We saw that he was an Edomite, a descendant of Esau, the people who traditionally populated southern Jordan and today are falsely called Palestinians. Some things never change. Another one, Herod the Great tried to kill the Christ as a child. Another Edomite, another descendant of Esau. What do these three guys have in common? They all have an irrational hatred for the chosen people. And we see them in our major cities today, don't we? 1400 years ago, the original false prophet and antichrist came along. And there have been many more since. The most notorious in the last 100 years is, of course, Adolf Hitler. Neither of these guys did miracles. If we are in the last days, there should be no shortage of antichrists today. Here's one. He's a false prophet and an antichrist. Hasn't done a miracle so far. Oh, by the way, latest intel is not only were they developing nukes, which they've refused to abandon, they're also developing EMP weapons, electric magnetic pulse, which takes out all your enemy's electronics so that you can then, they're fairly defenseless. All for peaceful purposes, of course. A couple of antichrists are no longer with us, and good riddance. Sinwar, head of Hamas, Nasrallah, head of Hezbollah, no miracles from them either, and they're gone. Oh dear, how sad, never mind. They have no problem with killing people on whatever scale it takes, just like their master, the devil. John 8:44, the devil was a murderer from the beginning. And using mass deception of propaganda to achieve their aims, and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. He is the dragon and the serpent. He is the sea beast and the earth beast. Well, back to John's section on Antichrist, let's skip ahead to verse 21. I have not written to you because you do not know the truth, but because you know it and that no lie is of the truth. So far, so good. Who is a liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? This is a lie that's been peddled by antichrists for a very long time. Who denies that Jesus is the Christ? Judaism. Apart from Messianic Jews. What else? Oh, we know why that is, don't we? Romans 11:25. For I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. When enough of us Gentiles have been saved, God will lift the blindness from Israel. How? Through the beast. Through the time of Jacob's trouble. When their technology and intelligence fails them, and they're obliged to turn to their true Messiah. It's tough, isn't it? This is tough love. What else? He is Antichrist who denies the Father and the Son. Who's that? Islam. Allah has no son. By the way, I had an argument with someone, well, I suppose it was a few months ago, who was saying that Islam recognises that Jesus, or Prophet Isa, as they say, is the Messiah. And what I couldn't get this person to understand is that that is a meaningless term in Islam. It means it's a title of respect. They say Isa was a prophet and a messenger of Allah, therefore that makes him a Messiah. It does not mean the anointed king who will rule over Israel and the world. They deny that Jesus is the Christ, though they deceive us to pretend otherwise. What else? 1 John 4:3. And every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard was coming and is now already in the world. Well, that covers the Gnostics. The Gnostics say that Jesus wasn't human or wasn't fully human, that he didn't do those miracles he did as a man. If Jesus wasn't human, our salvation is a failure. He couldn't die for us. So they say that the Christ Spirit, or some say the Christ Spirit came upon him at his baptism, and certainly the Spirit of God did empower him, but departed from him at the cross, leaving him merely human to die. Gnosticism, as I'm sure you know, comes from the Greek word gnosis, meaning knowledge. Gnosticism is secret knowledge, you know, secret handshakes and all the things that the rest of you just don't know. It so appeals to human pride and arrogance. I know something you don't know. Survives today with a lot less influence in secret societies like the Freemasons. We've seen this picture before. Here's an Anglican bishop playing Freemason games. Seriously? Would that be a conflict of interest? It should be. Should be, shouldn't it? Similarly, 2 John 7, for many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. It seems that in the late first century and beyond, the main attack on the truth was the humanity of Christ. Curiously, the church has spent its time from about the fifth century onwards pronouncing eternal damnation on anyone who denied the deity of Christ. Go figure. One of those little ironies of history, I guess. Now, the Apostle Paul also speaks of the last day's bad guy. We've seen this passage a number of times. 2 Thessalonians 2:3. Let no one deceive you by any means. For that day, the day of the Lord, the return of Christ, the kingdom of God, will not come unless the falling away comes first. That word in Greek, falling away, is apostasia. So we get the English word apostasy from. It means falling away from the truth, especially biblical truth. Will people fall away from the truth of the Bible in the last days? Would Christians, professing Christians, do it? I can see people nodding their heads. Yeah, imagine that. And the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. What's perdition? The Greek word is apolia, means waste, destruction, annihilation, total discombobulation. Why am I telling you this? Only one other guy in history in biblical history has been known as the son of Apollyon. Judas Iscariot betrayed the Son of God for money. It would be better for that man if he'd never been born. And I dare say the same applies for every antichrist and false prophet we've had throughout history. By the way, do you remember we looked at the abyss? The angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, which is Avadon, means Hebrew. But in Greek he is called Apollyon. Same word, right? Destruction, annihilation, discombobulation. Just threw that in, you can have it for nothing. Now, by the way, there is a textual variance here. Westcott Hort, modern English Bibles say man of lawlessness, for example, NIV. Doesn't matter, 1 John 3:4, whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. That's from John's perspective. He's explaining to us what he means. There is a subtle difference between them, not worth looking at today. 32nd bunny trail. As you know, I prefer the majority Greek texts, which is why I use the New King James and why I use the World English Bible for the Revelation series, rather than the Westcott Hort cafeteria text. And you say, why? Well, that's an easy one. Psalm 12, 6 and 7. The words of the Lord are pure words, like silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified seven times. You shall keep them, O Lord. You shall preserve them from this generation forever. Or did God fail to preserve the New Testament until two English gentlemen in the late 19th century said, wait a moment, we'll have to fix these thousands and thousands of manuscripts based on two earlier ones? I don't think so. Now you know. Back to 2 Thessalonians 2. Verse 8, doesn't matter because Paul refers to the man of sin as the lawless one. Same, same. The lawless one, the man of sin, the antichrist, the second false prophet, the earth beast. Continuing, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. Only David can defeat Goliath. Verse 4, how will we identify him? Who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And that is a nice segue into the book of Daniel. There's a couple of passages in Daniel that refer to Antichrist. Just want to look at one of them. As you know, commentators say that Daniel chapter 11 is all about this chap, Antiochus the Fourth. And he is a major, major prophetic type of the Antichrist. There are 45 chapters, I think, or 46. 46 verses, I should say, in Daniel chapter 11. And for the first 35 of them, Antiochus fulfills those prophecies in spectacular detail, to the point where liberals and intellectuals say that Daniel wasn't written by Daniel because God couldn't have known the future to that degree. Intellectual, like, really? It's prime stupidity to think you're cleverer than God. Anyway, what was I saying about arrogance a minute ago? They're probably all Freemasons. Yes, give them the secret handshake. Now, beginning in verse 40, for the last seven verses, these commentators have to try and make it fit. They have to massage it because it doesn't really work from verse 40 through 46. And that's hardly surprising. Daniel 11, verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. It seems logical. Remember, we've said prophecy is not prophecy for prediction fulfillment. It's patterns over and over again. If the prophecy is not fulfilled to the letter, there's another one to come. It's to prove to us that God is in control of time. So it's likely that the last verses, which we won't look at today, are all about the Antichrist. But here we are, and we said verse 35. What about 36 to 39? Are they about the Antichrist? Are they about Antiochus? Are they about both? Let's have a look. Verse 36. The king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god. Just as Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 2. And, of course, that clearly wasn't fulfilled by Antiochus, at least Paul didn't think it was. What else? He shall speak blasphemies against the God of God and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. What wrath is that? Well, certainly Antiochus was a horrible, evil man. Eventually his time came to an end when the Maccabees rose up and overthrew him. Or is this the time of Jacob's trouble at the end? Now it gets a little confusing. Look at verse 37. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all. What does that mean? The last bit's easy enough. He shall exalt himself above them all. We've seen that. But the rest of it, what do we do with the first half of this verse? Let me skip over the middle bit, the desire of women for now, and see what we can do with it. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers nor regard any God. A lot of commentators say Antichrist will be an atheist. Doesn't say that. Doesn't say that he doesn't believe in the existence of any God. The Hebrew word for regard is Rowan Atkinson. Bean is not to, it means to understand, consider, or pay attention to. He just won't listen to any God is what it's saying. But as we've seen recently, words like any to us as Greek thinkers are absolutes. In ancient Hebraic thought they're contextual. And we'll see in just a verse that he does regard a God, at least one anyway. This bit is misleading. God of his fathers with a capital G. I've heard sermons based on the English that said therefore he must be Jewish because God with a capital G is the real God. And he will turn his back on Abraham, Isaac, the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. That's speculative. There are no capitals in Hebrew. The expression Elohe Avotayo is a plural construct, more naturally translated as the gods of his fathers or the gods of his ancestors. That does not apply to Antiochus. Here's one of his coins. There's his face on one side and Zeus on the back. So at least he regarded Zeus. According to the non-scriptural text of 2 Maccabees, the books of Maccabees are in the Catholic Bibles, but they're not really canonical. 2 Maccabees chapter 6, verse 7, and in the day of Antiochus's birth, every month the Jews were brought by bitter constraint to eat of the sacrifices. Eating food sacrificed to idols, that's a big no-no, isn't it? And when the feast of Bacchus was kept, the Jews were compelled to go in procession. Bacchus was the god of wine, the party god. So there's another god that he regarded. This description, however, does work for the original first prophet. The Arabian Peninsula, prior to Muhammad, was a pagan polytheistic culture like so many other parts of the world. And he put a stop to that. You know the Kaaba, the cube thing? That contained originally, the outer structure wasn't there, but it contained a series of pagan gods, like a pantheon of gods. And he put a stop to that and said, from now on you will not worship these false pagan gods. Henceforth you will only worship my false pagan god, Allah. Now the bit we skipped over is also tricky, nor the desire of women. Some say that Antichrist must be a homosexual. I don't think that's what it's saying. I think it's ambiguous. The desire of women, chemdat nashim, means that which women treasure. What do women treasure? Well, in biblical times, they treasured marriage and children. Not with good reason, I must say. Because in those days, your sons, as a man, were your staff. They worked on your farm or on whatever occupation you had. Your daughters, you could get rid of them for a dowry and get some more money, to put it bluntly. For a woman, sons were social security. When husband died, men tend not to live as long as women, with good reason. No, I didn't say it. Don't tell my wife I said that. For a woman, the only way she could be not begging as a widow was to have sons to take care of her. As we see in the book of Ruth, a childless widow was a beggar or worse. So it was imperative to have sons. Today, of course, the modern beast empire doesn't care a jot about equality for women. Women desire to be treated with the equality and respect that they deserve as being created in the image of God, along with men. Well, the next verse confirms that he does serve a God. In their place, he shall honour a God of fortresses and a God which his fathers did not know. What can we say about a God of fortresses except, okay? What does that mean? Well, hang in there. We'll see it in the next verse if we keep going. Notice he will honour them, not just boon, not just regard. Kaved, he will glorify a God of fortresses. How? He shall honour with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. He will spare no expense in the honour of his false God. Moving on. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign God. His God of fortresses is one who projects his own ideology through military force to conquer other military forces. No expense is spared on military spending, on military hardware. Who spends the most money on their military? Well, that's easy, isn't it? It'd be like China and Russia and America. Yeah, they've got the most money. In terms of dollars, they obviously spend the most. But what about other countries that don't have that much money? What priority do they place on defence spending? How important is it to them? Globally, 2.4% of GDP. That's what the average nation in the world considers to be an important amount to spend on defence. Australia lags behind, 1.9%. That's a source of awkwardness between the current present administration and the current Australian administration. You say, well, it's only 0.5%. No. In terms of the amount of GDP, we're spending 3/4 what the rest of the world does. We don't think it's important, as the rest of the world does. Now, if you go to the Arab nations, it's 4%, more than double what we think. Where was I? Oops. If you add two nations, Afghanistan, we heard mentioned a little while, Pakistan, it jumps to 4.7%, double the world average almost. Pakistan doesn't need to spend that much. They got nukes. I remember when they got them saying, the world's first Islamic nuke, they said, and I thought, oh, goody. Well, what else? I should have said that Libya spends 15.5%. Saudi Arabia spends 7.1%. When I lived there, I was the 0.1%. That was all for me. What else? He shall cause them to rule over many, yes, and divide the land for gain. Wherever this ideology goes, it exploits the land for its own selfish purposes, by force, if necessary. So wait a minute, the land, is this the promised land again? In this case, no. The Hebrew word is adamah, it means the dirt, the earth, the soil. God created Adam, from the dust of the adamah. Get it? The rulers in these places live in opulent palaces. They spend a fortune on spectacular mosques. This is the Faisal Mosque in Pakistan. Meanwhile, 45% of Pakistanis live below the poverty line. You say, what is the poverty line in Pakistan? Anything less than 1,200 rupees a day. What's that in real money? $6.40. Almost half the country. Anyway. I should stop or I could go on and on and on, but that gives us a bit more of a handle on the Antichrist and the Antichrists and the one to come, maybe soon. And would you believe there's another scene change as we go into chapter 14? So stay tuned. What could we take away? Just a few little points. The final Antichrist will be, think of a miracle working Muhammad. Unless it's more than 30 years hence, then it could be anybody. He may masquerade as a man of peace. He probably will. You cannot accidentally pledge allegiance to him. It will be a conscious decision. Will you resist him and die? That's it, folks. Beep, 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 beep.